gratitude goes out to you today for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is a locally made exploration into positive solutions to some of today's ecological challenges for all of us working to create a healthier future for our communities and for the world you live in.
Thanks for listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. My name is Teresa Wilkie. On today's program, host Brent Ragsdale brings Frank Jacob into the studio to discuss all aspects of transitioning our energy sources from hydrocarbon fuels. Frank Jacob is a technology manager specializing in energy storage with Black & Veatch. Call-in questions and comments are welcome. Stay tuned. But first, the environmental news for the week of October 28th. Democracy Now! Reports, in California, high winds and bone-dry conditions fueled an explosion of new wildfires, with at least 9 active major fires now raging across the state. 18 million people are under red flag warnings across Southern California. In South Dakota, environmentalists are declaring victory after the state's Republican governor and attorney general agreed not to enforce laws allowing draconian fines and prison terms for protesters opposing oil and gas pipelines. 95% of baby foods in the United States contain either lead, arsenic, mercury, or cadmium. That's according to a shocking new national study by Healthy Babies Bright Futures, which tested 61 different baby food brands purchased across 14 different metropolitan areas. 1 in 4 tested baby foods contained all 4 types of heavy metals, which are linked to IQ loss from exposures early in life. In response to the study, New York Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer is calling on the Federal Drug Administration to examine the study and release a public statement on its findings. Sierra Club reports, thanks to the opposition of the Sierra Club and its coalition partners, the Mountain Valley Pipeline is having a month from hell. First, Virginia's Attorney General announced that the pipeline's developers must pay a $2.15 million penalty for committing more than 300 violations of clean water protections. Then, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission ordered all construction on the pipeline to cease immediately, because the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals granted Sierra Club's attorneys request for a stay of 2 necessary permits related to the Endangered Species Act. The Sierra Club and a diverse coalition of grassroots groups have been fighting the pipeline for 5 years. Despite this month's setbacks, Mountain Valley Pipeline, LLC, wants to keep building its unwanted, unnecessary pipeline. Topeka Capital Journal reports, one Butler County, Kansas community has already stopped its recycling program and another might. A Chinese ban on waste imports in 2018 was backed by strict contamination standards. When residents put things like diapers, mini blinds, and regular household trash into their single-stream blue container, it contaminates the whole load, the recycling system stated. There is not a magical process that exists for removing melted cheese and pepperoni grease from the top of a pizza box to make it a clean, recyclable material. It's simply trash at that point. Now, our show.
Hello, Kansas City. Welcome to Eco Radio KC. Thanks for listening in. My name is Brent Ragsdale. I'm going to be the main host tonight, along with Dave Bennett Freeling.
How you doing?
Running the board. He's also going to be taking your calls after our break, so in the second half of the hour. Our guest tonight is someone I'm really excited to introduce and talk with. His name is Frank Jacob. I'm going to give you a little better introduction in a minute, but first I just want to say welcome. I'm pleased to have you on the show.
Thank you, Brent. It's exciting to be here to talk about navigating the energy transition.
Yeah, I think something that we are both very passionate about. So, as you heard in the intro, Frank is an engineer for Black & Veatch here in Overland Park. He's got a lot of credentials and a lot of experience. He is a project management professional and a professional engineer. His title at Black & Veatch is Technology Manager, specializing in energy storage. So for his long 30-year career, I think he's done a lot of work. In the last, say, 15 years, I think I heard you say that you've been specializing in batteries and fuel cells and other energy storage systems and devices.
Exactly.
Sound like a good recap?
Well, yes, short, sweet, and accurate.
What got you interested in doing this, Frank?
As a career?
Yeah.
It would go back to that crucial teacher you have in high school who got me onto math and science, and that really, I was really good at it, and it also interested me. I went on to get my degrees in mechanical engineering, and one thread of mechanical engineering is all about power and energy. And I was in school during the first wave of conservation going on after the Middle East oil crisis a long, long time ago. And now I'm trying to make the results of that happen bigger, better, and faster these days.
All right. Well, full disclosure, I'm a mechanical engineer too, and I also like the power stuff, although I didn't go that way with my career, so I'm not nearly as learned or as accomplished, but I still have an interest in it. So earlier this year, Dave Mitchell, one of the hosts from Radioactive Magazine, he and I attended a Green Drinks event where you were the speaker, Frank.
Yes. Very, very interesting group of people there.
That was an interesting group and an interesting talk. So you spoke that night about battery technology.
Specifically, for
electric vehicles.
Yes.
I think some people in that group were worried about what was going to happen to the battery in their car once it was at the end of their life.
Right.
So that was an impetus of the topic. But
yes,
you gave, I thought, a really great overview of all the different technologies that there are for
there
batteries.
There are many.
And everything in the life cycle, from the mining of it, the environmental aspects of that, all the way to the recyclability. So I was really impressed with how easy it was to understand, I thought, for a layperson. So,
thank you. If we can't get the laypeople to understand it, then we're not trying to get the fundraising and the votes and other things to make legislation happen.
That's right. Dave Mitchell beat me to getting you on KKFI.
Yes.
So he had you on Radioactive Magazine in August, and your topic was a wind and solar revolution. And I would encourage our listeners to go back and find that podcast on kkfi.org and listen to it. But we're just going to try to do a quick recap of that, so hopefully we can kind of build on to where you got with Dave.
That'll be a great start. Bring us up to speed, and then we'll go forward from there.
All right. Well, I made a few notes, but what do you remember of that talk?
Well, how little renewable energy is contributing to the grid right now, upwards of 12%, 16% or so. And that's split between almost equally between wind and hydroelectric power. Hydroelectric is where you pump water, where you take river water or lake water and run it through. Mm. And then the rest is solar, and solar is coming up fast on their tail. So projections are to get from 16 to 25% sometimes in the next decade. And some aspirations are for 50% by the middle of the century. And other aspirations are 100% by the middle of the century. And so some people want to go faster and get greener and more renewable over that time frame.
Yeah, we want to talk about that for sure. And I have a feeling your kind of prognostications are going to be kind of in the middle of that. But we'll see where we end up. What about Kansas and this area specifically? What do we have
in this area of the country? Through the heart of Kansas is the United States' best wind resources. And that's where the first wind turbines and wind power plants were going up. It was kind of far removed from the population centers, and so that led to the building of transmission lines to send that electricity as it was generated, because there wasn't then, and is almost now, a large-scale ability to store that energy. But right across the border in Missouri, not so much. It can be that geographically specific. USA Today just had a article about who's the top 10 and who's the bottom 40 to 50 in the United States. And in the top 10 is Kansas at number 10, same family as California. And would you hazard a guess which state has the most renewable energy in terms of percent of total?
Texas?
Vermont.
Vermont. In percent of
over,
total.
Over 90% hydropower
The
mountains, mountains
makes
of Vermont.
Sense.
And Missouri is down at number 43 on that list of 1 to 50.
Pretty low. Not as much natural wind, though.
Exactly. The geological formations just weren't there.
And it's more treed, maybe more difficult to put in solar, potentially.
Definitely for solar. Not so much for wind, if there was a resource.
Yeah. So I know also that if you look at solar, Kansas is kind of lagging in solar. We're leading in wind, one of the leaders, but I think a lot of the states to our north and south and west are doing better in solar.
Most of those states are to the south and the east and west.
Yeah.
Being heavily powered with wind, then there's not much opportunity to get add extra capacity from the solar right now. The transmission lines are becoming saturated. There wouldn't be sufficient ability to transmit that energy to the population centers west into Colorado or down south towards Texas.
Yeah. So this gets a little bit into your area of expertise.
I know that when you
were talking with Dave Mitchell, he asked about some combined wind, solar, and storage plants.
Exactly.
Or maybe you brought it up. Can you give us an update on what that is and where it is and how they're doing?
Yes. First there was wind, and then solar came along. And then if you look at the resource profile, you know when the sun's going to be there, right? It's going to be there from morning to evening.
Yeah, absent any clouds.
It'll be intermittent, but there's still plenty of energy being generated with the clouds. Wind, on the other hand, is usually at its peak after midnight, when the load is the lowest. So again, there's the out of sequence of generation and capacity. And so what happens is curtailment, that the wind blades, it's like putting the brakes on your car. You know, the wind blades go down to generate only as much capacity as is needed at the time.
Yeah.
But these hybrid plants takes the solar peak during the day and the wind peak during the night, and that kind of levels things out over the course of the day. So you have a pretty predictable 24-hour profile of renewable energy when you combine those two. Layer energy storage on top of that to be able to move some of the energy from the peak times to the times when they're really needed, like early morning is where we're getting ready for work, and early evening as we're getting home from work and doing things at home. And that's a way to create firm, dispatchable energy from renewables, as we have been able to accomplish with traditional sources like nuclear and coal and gas.
So are there some plants being developed that are the combination of the three?
Yes. A company called NextEra, a very large developer of generation facilities, is planning on a 700 megawatt and matter of metrics, 700 megawatts would power 700,000 homes for an hour.
Yeah.
And then they're developing it in Oklahoma, and we may very well be the beneficiary of some of that energy being in such close proximity to where it's going to be generated.
Oh, nice. Well, I definitely want to talk more about that and the potential benefits from it. But first, I really want to stress that in your first talk with Dave, it was all about wind and solar and about electricity generation.
Yes.
But that's only a part of energy transition. If we're going to try to get off of fossil hydrocarbons, we've got to tackle quite a bit more than just electricity generation.
Exactly. As you wrote in your notes to me,
yes.
A third of our energy is going into electric generation, but two-thirds is used in transportation and buildings, commercial, residential, and the like.
Yeah. So I know you and I are both fans of a particular diagram, and I've printed this out for us. It's from the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. They produce this every year. It is called the Estimated U.S. Energy Consumption. And it's a one-page kind of diagram that's, I guess you could describe it as a sort of a flow chart.
Very much. Yeah. How energy flows from where it's mined, either the sun or the wind or coal or gas plants, and what it processes through to get to where it produces useful work we're willing to pay for.
Yeah. So on this particular diagram, they've got a long list of all the sources: petroleum, biomass, coal, natural gas, geothermal, wind, hydro, nuclear, and solar,
yes,
up the left. And then they break it up in terms of how we use that power into four broad categories, the biggest being transportation.
Of those four, excluding electricity, transportation's the largest, yes.
It's the largest. And then industrial uses, commercial, and residential. So it seems like there's a lot of information to be gleaned from this and
yes.
unpacked. What do you get from this chart?
What I get is that in the end, of all the energy we use, only about a third of it becomes useful.
What happens to the other two-thirds, Frank?
You burn gas in your gas stove, and it turns into heat. You use it in automobiles, in your engine, to drive, and trucks and buses. Industry uses a lot of it for processes, heating processes, or using actually the gas or coal in creating a secondary product that is then used. And in our homes, you know, we use it to heat water. We use it to heat and cool our home. We use it for lighting. Those are typically the three biggest categories. And the fourth biggest category always concerns me. It's the miscellaneous use throughout your home of all the chargers
yeah.
plugged in all the time, mm-hmm. of the instant
little phantom
on.
Loads.
That, yes, all those phantom loads.
I wonder what that amounts to in an average house.
I'll have to get a number for that, but yeah. it's one of the top five.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. Yeah, the other thing that jumps out to me is that transportation being the biggest besides electricity is also the least efficient.
Yes.
And that
by
I
how
think,
much? By how much?
By how much?
Me?
Yeah.
Fellow mechanical engineers.
Yeah, I think that an internal combustion engine is only efficient in the range of like 20 to 25%.
At best.
At best.
At best.
Yeah.
On average, probably 10 to 15.
Yeah. So that's why in the wintertime your car can keep you warm so easily. It has all that extra heat.
All that extra heat.
Yeah, that it's easy to send it into the cabin so that you can be warm, but
exactly.
not efficient at all.
A comparison point on that, you know, electric vehicles are becoming more and more popular. They're an excellent way of decarbonizing the transportation sector. A regular truck with a 30-gallon diesel tank, you're sitting on 1 megawatt hour of energy, enough energy to power 1,000 homes if you could convert it at 100% efficiency. When you get an electric vehicle, you have about 100 kilowatt hours of storage in the battery, 1/10. So because it's used very efficiently in the electric vehicle through motors to the drivetrain, whereas thermodynamically, the heat processes are bound by the temperatures you're working at. And if you can't have a very high or low temperature, it's going to be less efficient, and thus cars and diesel trucks have low efficiencies.
Yes. So Dave and I both are electric vehicle drivers. An argument I've heard people sneer to me a few times is that it's not green if we're creating that electricity with coal.
Exactly.
But my comeback on that is that we do have very renewable ways to produce that energy, and every year we're doing it more and more. And if we don't get off of a fossil fuel powered internal combustion motor,
mm-hmm.
we're never going to get to a green solution.
That's a good answer for them. What you might add to that is that the oil or gas being used in the vehicle is only being used at 10% efficiency. The electricity you're using to charge is produced at 30% efficiency. So you've kind of reduced by a factor of 3 the amount of carbon emissions in a total system basis that would be attributed to your vehicle.
So do you mean that if it were produced with a gas peaker plant or with coal, it would be at 30? But if it were produced with a wind turbine, then it would be...
Down at 0.
Down at 0, exactly.
And in KCK, where I happen to live, 45% of our power comes through wind and hydro.
Cool.
I'm a BPU customer, so Kansas City Board of Public Utilities, it's a smaller company, and
mm-hmm.
they've chosen to, you know, it's a unified government thing, so it's not really a company, it's kind of a... I don't know, not quite a cooperative, but...
We'll have to have a show on that someday.
Yeah. So.
And I think the number for Evergy, the new name for...
the merger of the two utilities.
Westar and KCP&L, I think they on their website say that it's their electricity is about 25% generated by renewables or by green energy, I guess. Maybe they're counting also Wolf Creek, but...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's getting better. So I think maybe the implicit takeaway from this whole conversation and this chart that we like is that if we're going to get to 100% renewables and off of greenhouse gas producing fossil fuels, we're going to have to electrify a lot of things. Would you agree with that statement?
I'd agree with that. Many policies across the states agree with that. And in Washington, it's a little more confused these days than it used to be.
Yeah.
But around the world, certainly. France would love to electrify because I think 75% of all their power comes from nuclear.
Yeah.
Generated power, zero carbon power. It's got other problems with it down the road that's got to be solved. But we're smart people. We could solve problems.
So I want to remind our listeners, we're going to be taking calls after our break, which is coming in about 5 minutes or so. So our studio number, if you want to give Dave a call and we'll patch you in, 816-931-5534. What's next on our list?
Well, perhaps why is energy storage needed for the power grid?
Yeah, that's your area of expertise. Let's talk about that.
And amazingly, as huge as electricity is as part of our economy and our culture and our creature comforts, historically it has not been able to be saved or stored. And so the power plants would have to follow the load as it's getting high during the day and lower at night. And that puts them in an inefficient operating regime. So electricity grids need to balance the load and the generation at every instant of time. And when it goes out of balance, we've experienced that all ourselves. The breakers blow in the power grid and we get a little bit of a blackout.
Yeah.
And so that balance is exceedingly important, and storage actually for the last 100 years has been helping the grid, and that's because of hydroelectricity. That comes from lakes, lake water running downhill to the bottom of a mountain, or rivers flowing. That's green, renewable power. Not devoid of environmental issues, though, themselves,
mm-hmm.
When it comes to fish and flora and fauna. But renewables, by their nature, are periodic. We talked about the wind peak and the solar peak. And they're also intermittent when clouds come by or the weather's just not a little stormy and there are gusts of wind. And so there are surges. Not only do we have to now balance the load against generation, but we've got to balance it all against intermittent and changing renewable energies. And so it's like one of those trapeze artists, not just holding two, but maybe having a third one up on top where they're all trying to keep in balance and keep falling down. And so... fundamentally, when we burn fossil fuel, it produces water. Well, fossil fuel, it's basically carbon and hydrogen. CH4 is methane. And nature did a miraculous thing in creating such fuels because it's one of the most energy-dense things we've ever invented. It's 100 times more energy-dense than batteries. Diesel fuel is more energy-dense than gasoline. About the only thing more energy-dense is refined nuclear elements. So we talked about gasoline for your cars. Think about it. It weighs 6 pounds. And about five-sixths of those are carbon molecules. And so there's a lot of carbon to be produced.
I was telling Dave that a few weeks ago, that if you converted that carbon to graphite, like a pencil lead, carbon can be in a lot of forms,
yes.
From a diamond to a pencil lead to you know, a gas that's dissolved in the atmosphere combined with oxygen.
To our bodies.
To our bodies are almost all carbon. But if you took that 5 pounds of carbon from a gallon of gasoline and put it into the form of a pencil lead, it would be a cube 4 inches by 4 inches by 4 inches. And so if then you think about how many miles you drive typically in a year and how big a volume that would take, it's about the same volume, your little stack of carbon, as the size of your car.
Each year.
Yeah. And, you know, we all know that you can put a sugar cube in a glass of tea and it dissolves away, but you can still taste it. And that's sort of the same thing that's going on.
Yeah, okay. That's what's happening.
Yeah.
A clarifying point around global warming.
Yes.
We talked previously about all the heat that's generated as we use energy. That heat doesn't substantially contribute to global warming.
It's like the waste heat from a car.
Like the waste heat from a car. The carbon dioxide that forms is far more of a greenhouse gas. That is, it doesn't allow the sunshine that came through the atmosphere to reflect back out to outer space. And that's the fundamental mechanism that's raising the Earth's temperature by tenths of a degree over a decade, over years. It seems to be accelerating.
So you're saying a hot car is nothing in comparison to the sun?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it gives us a lot more energy. There's enough solar energy hitting the Earth each day to power the next 5 centuries of world activity.
Wow.
Well, I think after the break, if we don't get calls, we are going to dive into the topic of energy storage, since we've got Frank Jacob here from Black & Veatch, and that is something that he knows a lot about.
That's a great idea. We had a call just a minute ago, I think from Brian was his name, and he did appreciate the discussion of just the topic of how much waste. You know, a lot of what we're looking at in that diagram you're talking about, and just a lot of what I know Amory Lovins was on the radio a few weeks back when we heard him out at the Prairie Festival, and he was talking about waste and how much more efficiency we've had, and that's really a big effort that we can continue to work on, because we're still only at, you know, 30% sounds great currently, and it's something we still can work on. So something else maybe we can talk more about.
Yeah, so that was Brian, the caller?
He was more interested in hearing more about that, too.
A good point. You know, you start by reducing your consumption. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the smartest thing to do.
Too. Inefficiency. Yeah, all those things. Yeah, yes. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Reducing consumption, but increasing efficiency.
Right. But increasing efficiency, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, why don't we take that break now, Dave?
Sounds great.
All right.
This is federal worker Cynthia Lee of the Department of Treasury Financial Management Service, and I encourage all of my federal worker friends to support KKFI 90.1 FM during the combined federal campaign. Donating a few dollars each pay period can help keep community radio on the air in Kansas City. Designate your tax-deductible donation to KKFI CFC Agency Code 21994. Thank you for supporting community radio.
What I know about the volunteers at KKFI is that we're quirky, cool, stubborn, intelligent, on edge, and heartfelt. We come from various parts of Missouri and Kansas to nurture this thing that we all hold so dear. And I believe it's because we can all be heard here, and that's what makes us so beautiful. So if you're listening and you're a KKFI volunteer, know that you are so very deeply appreciated for keeping community radio alive.
Journalism is under attack as the American media is subverted by propaganda. Join David Barsamian with the presentation where he exposes efforts of repressive governments to silence media on October 30th at 6:30 p.m. at the All Souls Church, 4501 Walnut, Kansas City. David is the producer of alternative radio heard here on KKFI. Tickets are available at Brown Paper Tickets or at the door. And for more information, go to ourfcm.org. The public service announcement of KKFI 90.1 FM.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. If you cause a flood that destroys someone else's home, it's considered a property rights violation.
And it shouldn't matter whether or not that's a consequence of building a dike or a dam or generating emissions that produce increases in sea level rise.
Jonathan Adler is a law professor at Case Western Reserve University.
A lot of the expected and predictable consequences of climate change are things that we recognize to be violations of property rights and have recognized as violations of property rights for centuries.
Adler says framing the issue this way could inspire more support for climate action, especially among groups that prioritize individual property rights.
If we accept that climate change is a problem, if we accept that it's causing the sorts of rights violations that libertarians normally think justify government intervention, that should shift our discussion from whether there's a case for government intervention to what type of intervention and how do we maximize the likelihood that that intervention produces the sorts of results that we're trying to get.
Like Climate Connections, subscribe to our free podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Okay, we're back with EcoRadio KC. Our guest in the studio is Frank Jacob, and we're talking about energy transition and what it's going to take to get us to a greenhouse gas producing free energy system in our future. So Frank's expertise is in energy storage systems, like ways that you could store electricity, say, on a grid. And everybody, I think, realizes that the batteries that we use on our devices, our cell phones, our electric cars, are very similar to storage devices that you could put on the grid.
Exactly.
Yeah. Is that just a standard, like, little unit that looks like a normal battery? What's inside those batteries?
What they look like, well, it depends. just like there are all sorts of models of cars. They're all cars, but they don't all look alike. But basically, electrochemistry is, we all experience it every day when we see something rusting. The iron and the oxygen in the air is forming actually a protection layer over the root metal. And they produce electrons in the process, and it's controlling that and taming that in battery cells, like what you put in toys or video game consoles and the like. They look very much like one form looks very much like a AA battery. That's what the company Tesla is producing for their electric vehicles, and you'd put. Each one produces about 3 volts. You want to have 48 volts coming out, so you got to put so many in series.
A whole bunch in series.
And then you put the rest in parallel to get the power that you want to get up to.
Okay.
And it's very modular. It's very modular. Yeah. So there's the cells, and they're built up, and the module is built up, and then several modules go into different vehicles to give them different ranges.
And so the Powerwall product that the Tesla Corporation's working on it, that uses that same cell technology to get your economies of scale up?
The same basic cell technology. The applications, sometimes you tune the electrochemistry to the particular application, the way, you know, when you get gasoline, you've got premium, you got regular and middle grade. So it's adapted to make its use most efficient that they're able to do. You asked another question about what's inside those cells. Go back 50 years, and we had carbon batteries. There was a carbon graphite thing that looked like a pencil inside, and there was other metals in there, and they were separated by a thing called an electrolyte that allows the ions, positively charged ions, to move back and forth as you produce electricity. The atom loses an electron, so it becomes a positive ion, and it moves to the other side, and that's where it picks up its electron again, and it gets recharged.
Yeah.
And common materials are steel and aluminum and organic compounds.
Yeah. In the talk at the Green Drinks, I was surprised to hear that a lithium ion battery doesn't have very much lithium in it.
Oh, right. Exactly. Thanks for bringing that up. It's the lithium ion that carries the charge, but less than 5% of it is elemental lithium. Most of it's carbon. Most of it, aluminum, is the outer shell. And there are other metals in there to make it work efficiently, some of which are very prevalent and easy to use, like iron. There's a lithium ion iron battery, but in electric vehicles today, mostly it's NMC batteries, nickel, manganese, and cobalt. And cobalt's not a very friendly element to be using, and the industry is trying to move away from it. It was great in the labs and the science to propel it forward, but the parts of the world that cobalt comes from are in tragic humanitarian disarray. And so people are working towards reducing the amounts of cobalt, if not eliminating them.
Great. So there
is a second type of battery, yeah. The one in your cell phone. It's more of a square, more of a rectangle. What do we call them in geometry? Parallelepiped. But if you could take those and stack them in series and put them in parallel. And there are a lot of batteries that are used in buses that are this lithium iron phosphate type that are more like a little book. It's the size of a little book. Much more energy stored in there. They're able to get the voltage out of it. And in a bus, you don't have nearly the space and weight constraints that you have in a passenger vehicle.
Okay.
And so it's not as energy dense or as energy efficient, but it is lower cost, and it's having its application shine in buses and trucks.
So all of these battery chemistry kinds of technologies that are being forwarded improve to make them more environmentally and safe and abundant, but also it's going to bring the cost down, similar to what we've seen with solar PV panels.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Progress makes change, and change makes dollars, and dollars become the savings that you have when you're doing solid engineering and safety-related research related to energy storage devices.
So I heard you get excited about some other types of batteries that we might be able to use in addition to chemistry-type batteries on a grid?
Yes, there's a wide variety that aren't electrochemically based. Everyone in the audience, you probably have had a very important energy storage device in your homes for decades, and that's the water heater. It trickle charges the water, makes it hot so that it's available in enough abundance for use in showers and laundry and washing dishes and so forth. So that's where you're taking either electricity or natural gas, and you're creating heat that heats the water, and then you get to use that water for its purpose. And so what people are trying to do in a similar fashion at utility scale power levels is to use, say, excess renewable electricity. You heard me mention we curtail it sometimes when it doesn't match the load. Mm-hmm. Well, if you take that electricity and you run it through salts or rocks, you could heat those to hundreds of degrees, and those hundreds of degrees could be used to create steam that goes through a steam turbine that generates back electricity. And companies as prevalent as Siemens and Mitsubishi are working on technologies and techniques to do that at scale in an efficient way. And it's exciting for me because you could put it anywhere. You don't have to put it on top of a mountain like pumped hydro.
Yeah.
Or you don't have to put it out in the desert like that solar power tower that's out there.
Yes, pumped hydro is a proven technology, but not so applicable in Kansas.
Exactly.
On the plains. We just don't have the elevation changes and the big reservoirs to make that really practical. We do have salt mines where we could potentially compress air. I know that's another idea that people have thought of.
Yes, compressed air. It's been around for almost 30 years now. Two plants were built in the world in the 1990s, one here in the States in Alabama, and the second one over in Germany. And they've been in operation since then, and they're doing exactly as designed. You use excess electricity to compress the air, put it down in underground caverns that could hold the pressure, and then you bring it back up to atmospheric pressure and process do work because of the pressure changes, and that work is used to generate electricity. On the pumped hydro front, though, people are conceptualizing you would make chambers down in that salt cavern, and you need at least 100 feet more feet elevation is better, but you would pump water from the lower part of the cavern to the higher part of the cavern. So you don't need a mountain to pump it up to. You'd have a chamber down below where you could get the elevation level and then run it through the same equipment that generates hydropower today.
One of my friends, another mechanical engineer, go figure, he is pretty excited about just using a gravity system. There's a, I think it's a French company, perhaps a Swiss company, called Energy Vault.
Oh, yes.
Have you seen that?
They burst onto the scene in the last 18 months.
Yeah, describe that to us.
Imagine if you have a bunch of Legos on the ground, only instead of Legos, they might be 2,000 or 3,000 pound concrete blocks, formed concrete blocks, so they kind of may fit together and have more stability as you stack them. And you just lift them with a crane, and you make level number one, level number two, level number three, and then that's storing the energy. You're lifting the concrete blocks against gravity, that takes energy. And then to recover the energy, you'd grab another type of crane, would grab that block and let it fall slowly to earth, turning a wheel, generating electricity.
So the motors, electric motors, are kind of a reversible process.
Yes.
Where if the weight's turning the motor, then it creates electricity. If the electricity's turning the motor, then it can lift the weight.
Then it can lift the weight.
Yeah, it's a neat idea. And I've followed some of the thermal ideas that you've talked about.
Let's go into those because those are really exciting.
I think they are exciting. There's one that's being tested in Germany. I think it's Hamburg, Germany, that Siemens, and I guess they're called Siemens Gamesa now.
International company.
An international company, yes. But this idea is to take an existing power plant that has been retired because it's no longer economic to burn coal to generate electricity, but they still have this all the infrastructure there, but that now instead of using coal to make the steam, they're using the excess wind power that they have because they have offshore wind there in abundance to heat rock. It's a basalt rock, which is a very abundant material on the planet. It's a volcanic rock that can take a lot of heat. So they've got it in an insulated box, can store that heat for days and days, and then when they need it, they run water through pipes in the rock, and it turns it hot enough to be steam and run the turbines. Isn't that a neat idea?
A neat idea. It sounds like what's called geothermal power on steroids, because geothermal is areas that are geologically active would have high temperature pockets down below, and you would pump a fluid down into those, get it up to operating temperature, bring it back to the surface to raise steam and generate power. But then, like pumped hydro and like compressed air, it's geologically, you need the geological circumstances to be able to operate it.
Yeah.
Doing what you talked about in Germany, The materials are simple and abundant, low cost. They have a profound existing infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
They retired the plant not because it was obsolete, but because it couldn't produce power as low a cost as alternatives. And so putting the steam turbine back in service and using the boilers to raise steam sounds like an excellent idea.
Yeah. Well, I think we need to get to the big question. How long is this going to take? I know a lot of people are probably wondering that. I in our preparation for this, I sent a couple of different examples, kind of on the pessimistic end and the optimistic end. One saying that, boy, this Green New Deal is going to take forever.
A physicist friend of mine always gave me an answer that always works. How long will it take? One. It'll take one decade, one century, yeah. one millennia.
Yes.
It'll take one of those.
Yes.
For lithium-ion batteries, a case study might be of interest, that the fundamental chemistry was invented in the 1970s by an interesting chemistry professor. His name's Goodenough, Professor Goodenough. But 1970s is when it was invented. The first commercial product came out in the 1990s, and it wasn't scalable to grid scale until 2010. And so it's taken almost 40 years to go from the invention in the laboratory to having commercial projects that are viable in today's economy.
Yeah.
So it's not always simple or easy or fast, but there's lots of market data that you could look at how fast have cell phones gain market share.
Yeah, there seems to be an acceleration in the world too, to where maybe it took longer to go from the telegraph to the telephone as it took
from the telephone
to the internet.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah. So.
So what are the examples?
Yeah. Let's talk about the pessimistic one first. There was an article in Forbes that really just brings up the point of what a monumental task we've got to replace all of this energy. And so this was a Forbes article entitled Net Zero Carbon Dioxide Emissions by 2050 Requires a New Nuclear Power Plant Every Day. So it makes the point that we would have to install like a nuclear power plant every day, or two wind turbine towers every day, and retire that amount of fossil fuel generation
at
the same time from now until 2050 to make this work. So, yeah, what was your point about President Kennedy and his challenge?
Well, we got a challenge in the beginning of the 1960s to get on the moon by the end of the decade. And some people at the time thought that would never happen. Some people at the time thought it would take a millennia or a century. But smart people made it happen by the end of the decade.
Yeah, took one, and this time it was one decade.
One decade.
Nice.
And so that point that you made, I want to stress, that is, there's so much conventional generation out there already existing. A little bit of it's being retired as it becomes not economical compared to the new alternatives. But the new alternatives aren't coming along fast enough to displace more of that. And so the author of the article pointed out that you need this small nuclear plant size coming online every day until 2050, while at the same time retiring an equivalent amount of conventional generation. Now, that nuclear plant coming online could be a combination of nuclear and wind and solar, and perhaps we'll get biofuels at some point, although we'll probably have a debate on the show someday about whether biofuels are good, since they may be carbon neutral, but they're not carbon zero.
Yeah. A point that I would like to raise with that author is that, back to our diagram, and the fact that because we burn these fossil fuels that are inefficient, we're only getting one-third of that power consumed as useful energy.
Right.
And it seems to me then that we don't have to replace all of the energy that we're burning. We only have to replace it a third of that if it's going to be with the super efficient.
That's a way to get there.
Yeah.
That's a way to get there.
Yeah. Well, we're about to wrap up. I really appreciate your time. I hope this was a fun experience to come in and talk.
It's always wonderful to talk about what I'm passionate about.
I can tell you're passionate. Anything else? Any other parting words of wisdom for our listeners before we wrap it up?
It's a hard problem, but we're, as human beings, I think we're built to solve the hard problems. And we've got a lot ahead of us to get to green and renewable, but be confident we'll get there. It may not be on your timeline or my timeline, but we'll get there.
All right.
Right on. And would there be any last minute research sources? Where should people look to learn more about something?
Every government lab, like the Lawrence Livermore National Lab has information out there. Another lab, Sandia National Lab, is heavily into batteries. The Department of Energy, Energy Information Association, EIA, has a massive amount of historic and forecasted energy use that they update periodically, usually at least annually. And one thing you'll notice these days that their last year's projections for renewables were not as high as we're actually achieving, and last year's projections for retirement were not as large as they have become. And so we're in this growth mode where things are being forecast, and it could help guide policy, it could help guide investments in different technologies.
Great. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Yeah, thanks for having me, Brent.
All right.
Here's the calendar of events for the week of October 28th. Wednesday, October 30th, 11 a.m., Extinction Rebellion's First Civil Resistance in Kansas City, Missouri, gathering at the Food Court, Commerce Bank Building, 10th and Walnut, with noon action by persons already trained in civil disobedience and nonviolence, all to save the environment. On Friday, November 1st, Fridays for Future weekly strikes, 12 noon, Wesco Beach, Kansas University, and City Hall, 6 East 6th Street, Lawrence, Kansas. Every Friday, Sunrisers will strike in Lawrence from noon to 1 p.m. It's a small gesture, a meditation on climate, and a chance to remind passersby of the urgency of climate action. Friday, November 1st, 6:45 p.m., the Blue River Watershed Association's annual Water Ball will be at the Uptown Theater, 3700 Broadway, Kansas City, Missouri. This event is cocktail attire, dinner, live auction, and dancing. Tickets are available at brwa.net. Saturday, November 2nd, 10 a.m. Drawdown Getting Into Action Workshop Series will be at Temple Buddhist Center, 707 West 47th, Kansas City, Missouri. Saturday, November 2nd, 9 a.m. to 12 p.m., Help the Heartland Tree Alliance plant more trees in the Mannheim neighborhood, Kansas City, Missouri. Sign up at bridgingthegapbtg.org. In Missouri, find the best locations for catching the brilliant colors of fall maples, oaks, hickory, and ash trees at the Missouri Department of Conservation website, mdc.mo.gov. This week, they suggest a drive in Missouri on 45 and Missouri 224 along the Missouri River near Kansas City. November 3rd, 2 to 4 p.m., All Souls Drawdown, Getting Into Action, is a workshop designed to give participants the support to create and sustain action in their communities to reverse global warming. This will be at All Souls Unitarian, 4901 Main, Kansas City, Missouri. Please listen to Eco Radio KC next week when the topic will be about products created from recycled plastics in Missouri. These items and more can be viewed on the Eco Radio KC Facebook page. Stay tuned now for Fiesta Music Hall.
Climate catastrophe is coming, says the U.S. Army, and Americans could face a grim future. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
U.S. military officials have been warning for some time about the threats to national security from climate change.
Now, a study from the U.S. Army War College that has received little attention warns that without serious investment in new technology and infrastructure, Americans could face a grim future, including blackouts, disease, thirst, starvation, and war.
The report calls on the Pentagon to urgently prepare for the possible collapse of power, water, and food systems as mid-century approaches. According to Vice News, the report was commissioned by the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, who is a Trump appointee.
Parts of the report are backed up by recent fires in California. The Army warns that the power grid is aging and operates without coordination and investment. As Vice notes, PG&E has been criticized for failing to update its infrastructure.
Significantly, the report does not address the fact that humans are causing climate change or the U.S. military's role in contributing to it as the world's single biggest institutional consumer of fossil fuels. In addition, according to Vice, the authors do not seriously explore solutions to the crisis that could avert the dire circumstances it predicts.
Another study came out last week about infrastructure, this one from Colorado State University, saying that many of the 600,000 bridges in the U.S. are threatened by rising temperatures from climate change.
Many bridges built since World War II are made of beams that span two piers. They contain joints which allow the bridge to expand as the temperature rises, but the joints are often clogged with debris, preventing expansion.
Engineers at Colorado State reasoned that higher average temperatures in the future were not considered when the bridges were built, but could lead to thermal stress, causing buckling and cracking.
In the next couple of decades, nearly 25% of bridges could see a section collapse, with even more failing as time passes. The researchers concluded that bridges in the Northern Rockies and Plains, the Northwest, and Upper Midwest were the most vulnerable to increases in temperatures.
While attention has been understandably focused on the health risks posed by vaping, there are growing signs that e-cigarette devices and their pods could be a huge environmental issue.
People cleaning up beaches are noticing the pods from Juuls and other vaping devices adding to cigarette butts as trash and plastic pollution that will wash into the ocean.
Many who vape are under the impression that they do less damage to the environment than cigarette smokers. However, Earther reports that devices are more like smartphones containing lithium batteries and heavy metals. The pods used inside the e-cigarettes are made of hard plastic that can't be recycled and will never degrade when discarded.
Without any plan for the appropriate disposal of the paraphernalia, the device makers are placing the cost of cleanup on taxpayers and volunteers.
To remedy the problem, there are calls for a $5 deposit on vaping devices and $1 for each pod.
They call themselves the Fantastic Grandmothers.
Seven women are working in the South Pacific Ocean as citizen scientists collecting data on sea snakes.
The grannies are recreational snorkelers and are helping scientists understand the aquatic snake population of New Caledonia, a French territory east of Australia.
The seven ladies range in age from 60 to 75, and The Guardian reports that they've been photographing not just any snakes, but lethal ones. In all, the ladies have identified more than 140 greater snakes in over 2 years.
The grandmothers swim up to 3 kilometers a day, 5 days a week, and send their photos to two researchers who themselves had noticed some of the venomous species but thought they were anomalies.
It all began when one of the grannies met a researcher while snorkeling. Other women joined in until there were seven.
As the grandmothers supplied photos, the scientists discovered that they had vastly underestimated the population of the sea snakes. They have published a paper based in part on the women's work.
And finally, just in time for Halloween, we have a story about the northern snakehead, the largest fish to walk on land. Seemingly the stuff of nightmares, the fish have sharp teeth, can survive out of water for up to 4 days, and authorities in many southern states want them killed on sight.
But luckily, humans can easily outrun a snakehead, and they won't hurt children or pets. However, the damage to ecosystems could be devastating.
The snakeheads have been discovered in 14 states, destroying food webs as they eat native species of fish, frogs, and even small mammals like mice. Originally from Asia, the northern snakehead looks similar to a bowfin and was first found in the United States in 2002.
So what's driving the snakehead onto land? A new study from Wake Forest researcher Noah Bresman says certain water conditions make the fish take a walk.
Bresman studied snakehead populations in Maryland, where the creature is a threat to the Chesapeake Bay watershed. The fish, which can grow up to 3 feet long and weigh up to 18 pounds, were subjected to a range of poor water conditions, from high temperatures, pollution, to low light.
Turns out that high salinity, acidity, and too much carbon dioxide forced the fish to crawl out of the water, Bressman said that's information that could help natural resource agencies contain the snakehead.
In case you're wondering how they move on land, Bressman observed that the fish make rowing movements with their pectoral and lower fins.
The reason the snakeheads were brought to this country from China is because they are tasty and very nutritious. So one way to address the invasion might be with a fork and knife.
This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association, whose North American Water Loss Conference will showcase innovative solutions December 3rd through 5th in Nashville. Get the details at awwa.org/waterloss.
Eco Radio is produced by a team of collaborators, including yours truly, Craig Lubo, Teresa Wilkie, Dave Bennett, and Brent Ragsdale. Thanks to Ryan Porky for our theme music. I'm Richard Mabian, reminding you to give your feedback by contacting us at ecoradio@gmail.com or reaching out to Eco Radio KC, our Facebook page.